I regard myself as a soldier, though a soldier of peace.
I have a dream that one day
a soldier of peace,
this nation will rise up,
a soldier of peace,
live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream,
though a soldier of peace.
I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted. Every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the power of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it.
Nonviolence Radio, covering the beat of nonviolence worldwide, from the Meta Center for Nonviolence in Petaluma, California.
Nonviolence in a normative sense, that is, you know, one who recognizes the ethical imperative of dealing with others in, and for that matter, the planet, in a nonviolent manner. And there's a you know, there what that entails, of course, can vary considerably individually. You know, whether it includes things like eating animals, you know, whether in various lifestyle choices, is it non-injury to others. You know, could one justify property violence, but not, you know, violence against humans in a, you know, a literal, you know, a case of me or him kind of thing? Is violence legitimate in self-defense? I mean, these are, you know, struggles that I, and I think, you know, quite a few other, you know, people, you know, have to struggle with. I do not consider myself a complete pacifist at this point, but I'm certainly very much at that end, towards that end of the spectrum. My main interest in nonviolence, however, is the use of nonviolence as a form of political struggle. That is, you know, a means, you know, by which you know, to struggle for you know, peace, justice, human rights, the environment, accountable governance, etc., using you know, forms of nonviolent resistance, and in cases where the electoral system and conventional politics doesn't work, but also out of the recognition that a violent struggle, even putting aside the ethical considerations, tends to usually be counterproductive, and or at least not as effective as the nonviolent alternatives. And so, you know, my interest as a scholar of social movements, as well as someone who has been part of nonviolent action campaigns, you know, myself, is in this kind of nonviolence.
That was Dr. Steven Zunas, professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, a renowned nonviolent strategist and thinker. I'm Stephanie Van Hook, your host on Nonviolence Radio and the director of the Meta Center for Nonviolence. I invite you to join me for the next half an hour as Dr. Zunas describes the occupation of Western Sahara, some of the nonviolence that's taking place there, some of his analyses on the strategy being used, and finally, what we can do from his perspective as individuals and groups in order to help build momentum around the nonviolent movement in Western Sahara. And most of all, to be inspired that nonviolence is taking place all over our world, even though it's not being reported by the mass media.
Well, obviously it is in the western end of Sahara Desert. It formerly was known as Spanish Sahara. It was one of only two colonies of Spain in Africa. And it's you know, located on the Atlantic coast, just south of Morocco. It borders Mauritania on the south and much of the west. And a tiny strip of, I'm sorry, on the east, south, Mauritania's in the south and east, and a narrow strip of Algeria on the northeastern corner. The territory, which is about the size of Colorado, is mostly desert. It was populated largely by nomads. The Spanish colonial presence was relatively minimal in that they controlled the territory you see on the map by virtue of the Congress of Berlin in the 1880s, which divided up Africa. But there was a degree of benign neglect, at least in the interior. They helped build a few towns on the coast for the sake of commerce, particularly the phosphate mines at Bucra, which were quite important, and ended up employing a fair number of Western Saharans, known as Sahrawis. They are ethnically distinct from Moroccans. On the one hand, they are, like Moroccans, a mixed Arab and Berber ancestry, and they and are overwhelmingly Sunni Muslim, but they speak a very a different dialect of Arabic. In fact, the written language is the same. It's actually hard for Moroccans and Sahrawis to understand each other, and the spoken language. They also their cultural practices are different in terms of their dress, in terms of their food. Their practice of Sunni Islam is a through a liberal interpretation of the Maliki jurisprudence, which includes women keeping their maiden names, having equal rights to inheritance and divorce, greater respect for women than one generally finds in Moroccan culture. So there are distinct differences to be sure, and people of Western Sahara have never really known colonialism that much. Again, because they were never part of the Ottoman Empire. Again, Spanish colonial control was limited, so they have a strong sense of freedom. Again, very different than Moroccans, who've been under a centralized monarchy for quite a few centuries, not to mention the Ottoman influence and the Spanish and French colonialism and the like. So they've been struggling for self-determination. Spain was one of the like Portugal was late in its decolonization of Africa, and their slowness prompted an armed struggle led by a group known as the Polisario Front, which began in the early 1970s. And in 1974, with pressure from the armed resistance, as well as pressure from the United Nations, the international community, Spain did agree to end its colonization as of early 1976. The Moroccans, however, along with Mauritania, claimed that Western Sahara was actually part of their territory. Mauritania did so because the ethnic Sahrawis also populate parts of northern Mauritania, so there is the ethnic ties. Where in Morocco, claiming that there are certain Sahrawi tribal leaders who pledged fealty to the Sultan back in the 19th century. Well, these competing claims all went to the International Court of Justice in The Hague, ruled that notwithstanding these claims by Morocco and Mauritania, that the right of self-determination was paramount. And Spanish Sahara, being a recognized non-self-governing territory, according to international law, had the right to independence, or had the right to self-determination, and by definition, self-determination includes the right of self independence. So, for example, most former colonies decide to have independence, but some colonies, you think of Puerto Rico, Martinique, Guadeloupe, in the case of the Caribbean, Reunion, and the Indian Ocean. There are a number of colonies have decided they would prefer to remain part of the colonial power. Again, it's their right, but it's the people's choice, and that was the fundamental question. Well, Moroccan Mauritania realized that the people really had a choice. If they went ahead with a referendum, they would probably choose independence, and so they tried to preempt that. Meanwhile, the United States was concerned that the leftist Polisario might end up leading this new country. And as Henry Kissinger put it, so we don't need another Angola on the North Atlantic. And started pressuring Spain, which was then preoccupied with the long-term dictator Franco on his deathbed, to renege on their promise of a referendum. and to take over to hand the territory over to Morocco and Mauritania, and that's what they did. They ended up giving the northern two-thirds to Morocco, the southern third to Mauritania, though it was supposed to be administration, not sovereignty, and pending an act of self-determination. Well, the act of self-determination never took place. Mauritania actually gave up its third, to the Sahrawis, but Morocco ended up immediately taking that over as well. So the Moroccans ended up conquering the country. About half the population had to flee as a result of horrific repression by the invading Moroccan army. They to this day live in refugee camps in nearby Algeria. But the Polisario Front did declare at the official date where Spain was supposed to have pulled out the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic as an independent nation, and it's recognized by nearly 80 countries. Indeed, it's a full member of the African Union. So so in other words, in terms of international law, the United Nations, the International Court of Justice, and the countries of the region, this is a sovereign country that is under foreign belligerent occupation, and the people who have been denied their right of national self-determination according to international law. There was a guerrilla war with the Polisario, who had been fighting the Spanish, turning on the Moroccans. It ended in a stalemate with Morocco controlling about three quarters of the territory, and long before the Israelis, they ended up building a big separation wall, and a ceasefire went into effect in 1991 where Morocco agreed to finally go ahead with this long-awaited referendum, but they refused to do this. They basically tried to stack the voter rolls with Moroccan settlers. Indeed, at this point, Moroccan settlers outnumber the indigenous Sahrawi population by more than 2-1. They've built up an enormous infrastructure, but pretty much at the benefit of the settlers, not the indigenous population. They suppress any kind of protest or any kind of calls for self-determination and discourage the Sahrawis from practicing their unique culture, basically trying to Moroccanize them. But since the ceasefire, Sahrawi, especially since the about 15 years ago, the Sahrawis have begun engaging in nonviolent resistance against the occupation, realizing that guerrilla warfare would be counterproductive. They'd almost certainly be labeled terrorists or whatever if they took up arms. Have been engaging in a whole series of nonviolent campaigns, and they've been met consistently with brutal suppression. Part of the problem, of course, is if you are a minority in your own country, and this is what the Tibetans have found, for example, and in some other cases, it's particularly difficult to challenge the occupation by whatever means, whatever tactics you use.
You're at Nonviolence Radio, and you're listening to Stephen Zunas, professor at the University of San Francisco, discussing the conflict in Western Sahara. Let's turn back to him to hear some more.
I'm not aware of extensive study into nonviolence. This is a lot of it has been spontaneous. And many of the Sahrawis themselves have been admiring the bravery of their compatriots in the face of brutal repression, have been concerned as it has not been as strategic as it would be ideal. Some NGOs have passed on materials and done workshops and the like. Though Sahrawis have attended these workshops, have often been marked for imprisonment and torture upon their return, which has discouraged people to pursue that much further. Often the tactics will be spontaneous street demonstrations, and are usually broken up within minutes. Their use of boycotts and alternative institutions, other forms of non-cooperation, You know, sometimes there's some creative graffiti, including the Moroccans, who were primarily colonized by the French, you know, replaced all the Spanish signs with French signs, and so the Sahrawis painted over with the Spanish language version. One particularly clever action I heard about recently was involved cats. You know, Al-Aaiun, the capital, like a lot of North African cities, had a lot of feral cats. And in the occupied Western Sahara, any display of the Western Saharan flag, will immediately get the person punished. If it's painted on the wall overnight, it'll immediately be whitewashed. Well, they gathered all these cats together by offering them food and put these little paper Sahrawi flags on their tails. The next morning, you had all these Moroccan occupation troops in their riot gear running through the alleys trying to chase down these cats, you know, making total fools of themselves. And you know, again, example of some of the creativity that, again, you know, it serves as a reminder that the people are resisting, the people are not, in fact, accepting the status quo, even though, you know, that these kinds of tactics in and of themselves will not end the occupation. I think what we're looking at is something similar to East Timor. When it was under Indonesian occupation, that the impressive nonviolent resistance they had there, which was similar small-scale acts that were immediately suppressed by force, weren't in and of themselves enough to end the occupation, but it helped challenge the myth that people were happy under occupation, challenged the myth that was a fait accompli, that East Timor had been successfully incorporated. And it raised awareness to the international civil society that bad things were going on, that Western governments were complicit, and therefore aided the international campaign to stop U.S., British, Canadian, Australian backing of the Moroccan occupation, which ended up, in fact, making the difference, and East Timor is now free. And so I think in terms of what extent the Sahrawis do have a strategy, it's just to keep the struggle going as much as they possibly can, in the hopes that the global civil society will take notice and do something about it. Well, yeah, I do think both East Timor and the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa would be good models in terms of making it making an issue. I have long advocated that the BDS movement on Palestine include Western Sahara, and the reason I say this is that Western Sahara is the only other case of a country that is under occupation, in violation of UN Security Council resolution, recognized non-self-governing territory. I mean, there's some countries like Tibet, which I think morally have the right of self-determination, but unfortunately are not legally recognized as such. Western Sahara, you know, like the occupied territories that Israel controls, are recognized by the international community legally as under foreign belligerent occupation. And so basically saying we support the boycott, divestment, and sanctions of companies that support these illegal occupations. And it again, as with the West Bank, it only involves a handful of companies, so it wouldn't dissipate the Palestine movement much. In fact, I think it would strengthen it, because we'd get away from this title argument, why are you singling out Israel, the world's only Jewish state, and the criticism of anti-Semitism, et cetera, saying, no, you know, this is not about Israel being Jewish, it's about Israel being an occupier. See, we oppose the occupation by a Muslim Arab state as well. I think, you know, making linkages with Palestine would be very, very important and useful. But I think the also the very fact that that the Sahrawis, you know, despite the horrific repression and the lies and being isolated, they've never engaged in terrorism. They have stuck with their overwhelmingly nonviolent forms of resistance. And again, there are some issues, but by and large, you know, it's again more open, pluralistic, democratic liberation struggle than we've seen in most cases. And again, the role of women it has been quite significant, particularly for an Arab Muslim society. It challenges a lot of Western stereotypes we have. In fact, the most prominent leader of the nonviolent resistance inside Western Sahara is Aminatou Haidar, who's been known as the Sahrawi Gandhi. The very fact that one of the most key national liberation struggles of Arab Muslim people in the world is led by a woman committed to nonviolence, I think that's significant, and that more people need to know about it. There have been a number of excellent films on Western Sahara, including Sons of the Clouds, which is actually produced by Javier Bardem, the famous Academy Award winning Spanish actor. It's won quite a few awards at various film festivals and the like that came out, I think, about 2 or 3 years ago. That's probably the best one to date. There have been a number of others as well. But again, these are pretty well known in Europe. They haven't gotten much circulation, again, outside of film festivals here in the United States. Part of the problem is that getting into the territories and filming. I mean, I have been to close to 80 countries in my life, including Iraq under Saddam and Indonesia under Suharto, and I've never seen a worse police state than occupied Western Sahara. I mean, Morocco itself is liberalized somewhat, since the King Mohammed came in power about 18 years ago. But once you get into the occupied territories, it's incredible. The police and military presence, the undercover presence. I mean, the Moroccan troops and occupation forces at this point outnumber the indigenous Sahrawi population. It's incredibly militarized society. So it's been very difficult. I mean, it's routine for journalists to be denied entries or expelled. When I was there, I had to, go to some great lengths to make sure I'm not being followed and go into safe houses to interview people and the like. This is a very difficult situation in terms of getting the word out, and it's just been very disappointing that so many American politicians, including former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, would heap all this praise of Morocco about its liberalization and democratization and rights for women, when in fact in the occupied territories it's incredibly repressive. Well, I think we need to stop providing military assistance to Morocco, and the, a lot of the equipment we use ostensibly for counter-threat terrorism and policing is used for active repression against nonviolent dissidents. I think that'd be an important area that we can target. Though it's varied somewhat from administration to administrations and often within administrations, the Obama administration was pretty divided on this. But we need to put our government on the side of the vast majority of the international community in supporting the right of self-determination and stop threatening to veto UN resolutions support the right of self-determination. One small thing we could do is that every 6 months the United States, this is part of a group of nations that renews the mandate from UNRSO, the United Nations peacekeeping force that was brought in when the ceasefire went into effect. UNRSO is the only UN peacekeeping force in the world that does not have a human rights monitoring mechanism. They're not even allowed to, few are empowered to enforce human rights provisions, but at least, they're required to report human rights violations. The UNRSO is not the case. In fact, there have been proposals that UNRSO not just report on the human rights abuses in the Moroccan occupied territories, but human rights abuses in the Polisario-run refugee camps in Algeria as well, which are not nearly as severe as what's happening in the occupied territory, but they're not non-existent either. I mean, it'd be perfectly reasonable to look at both. And, you know, except for one half-hearted attempt that was immediately dropped under Obama, the United States has not pushed including this human rights monitoring role, you know, for the peacekeeping forces. So that's one small step that could be taken. I'm interested because I am interested in justice and human rights. It's interesting that my sense is if the world can't get something like, it's the same reason I'm interested in Palestine, same reason I'm interested in East Timor. I mean, if the international community cannot get something as basic as the right of a people not to be under foreign military occupation, the right of people for self-determination, the concept that it's wrong for a country to invade, occupy, and annex another country. I mean, that is fundamental. That's in the UN Charter. That's what World War II was supposedly fought about. That's what World War I was supposedly fought about. You know, if we can't get that right, you know, how are we going to get right, you know, some of the more the broader questions of racial and economic justice and social equality and the environment and all these other things. I mean, there's nothing particularly radical here. I mean, this is good old fashioned mid 20th century liberalism we're talking about. That, you know, we supposedly worked that out already. And so here, why is Morocco still getting away with something as flagrantly illegal and wrong as invading and occupying and annexing a weaker neighbor? I mean, that's just kind of basic. And so, you know, I think that's, you know, I am a post-war baby, you know, things you know, like that were kind of a given. And so, you know, it's very, very frustrating that we're still having to argue about this, you know, well into the 21st century. So I think that is one thing that really, really inspires me. But there's also the fact that, you know, that again, the Sahrawis, again, have never engaged in terrorism, you know, have kept their end of the ceasefire despite the bargain being broken all these years, that they are really trying to do everything right, you know, through diplomatic and legal channels, through nonviolence. You ought to at least give people a little credit, because we hear all the time, oh, well, those Arabs, those Muslims, they're terrorists, and, you know, they da-da-da, and here is an Arab Muslim people who soundly reject that kind of extremism, you know, not just in terms of their tactics, but in terms of their practice of Islam, in terms of their governing structures. I mean, these are the kinds of Arabs and Muslims supposedly the West should like. Instead, we're supporting the authoritarian government suppress them. And so I think that's another thing that draws me, is that the Sahrawis in particular, you know, have, you know, because they've rejected, violence and are working nonviolent, they deserve a little credit. They deserve support for having done so. And in fact they do challenge a lot of ugly stereotypes that the West has about Arabs and Islam. People need to know about these kind of struggles, not just the ones of fanatics with guns and explosives. And finally, there's the fact that not many people know about this, and people need to know about this. So this needs to be on the radar of people. I mean, even folks I know who are very much into third world solidarity and justice and, you know, all this kind of stuff, even that crowd is profoundly ignorant about what's happening in Western Sahara. And more people do need to know about, particularly given that our own government in Washington is complicit.
There is an indefinable, mysterious power that pervades everything. It transcends the senses. While everything around me is ever changing, ever dying, there is a living power that is changeless, that holds all together, that creates, dissolves, and recreates. सबको सम्मति दे भगवान ईश्वर अल्लाह तेरो ना सबको सम्मति दे भगवान ईश्वर अल्लाह तेरो ना सब
Greetings, everyone. This is Michael Nagler with the first part of our nonviolence news on this episode. And on the heels of the brilliant analysis that we just heard from Stephen Zunas about the struggle in Western Sahara, and that Sahrawi struggle is a clear, in fact, I would say an inspiring example of creativity, of courage, of what they would call in Arabic sumud, endurance, persistence. But again, they have the disadvantage of not having much access to training, education, or strategy, which is why Meta works so hard on exactly those three things. And to follow that up, I would like to read to you part of a report that came out in the ICNC, International Center for Nonviolent Conflict, their very valuable service called Minds of the Movement. Yesterday, they had an article on Mauritania, which we just was hearing about. Mauritania outlawed slavery in 1981, if you can believe that. But they have refused to acknowledge, much less address, its persistence throughout Mauritanian society. And I don't want to go into the whole story here, but I do very much want to read you a quote from a man named Biram, who is a leader of the courageous nonviolent resistance or abolition struggle against slavery in Mauritania. And here's what he said. Bear with me because the whole thing is very valuable. Quote, "For religious, moral, and other reasons, the founding members of IRA, that's the abolition movement, do not believe that violence carries any benefit or utility. Violence is counterproductive to humanitarian actions. It can spiral out of control. It espouses evil, oppression, and injustice, which only draw us back into violent terrains, which give the advantage to such forces. Responding to violent actors with violence only justifies the atrocities, destruction, and misery they cause." And Biram goes on, "Our nonviolent Pacific ideology and action are part of what will continue to allow humanity to survive and prosper in peace. Nonviolent action certainly resonates with the aspirations of oppressed people, but perhaps equally as important, with the buried and dormant aspirations of violent people who belong to oppressive groups." Would you let me repeat that last phrase? Nonviolent action resonates with the buried and dormant aspirations of violent people who belong to oppressive groups. And this is a cardinal principle in nonviolence, that you are never against persons. You are actually liberating your oppressor as much as you are liberating yourself. And this again helps what Stephen Zunas, the point that Stephen Zunas was trying to make. This is an Arab. This is a follower of Islam. And yet his nonviolence is about as deep and principled and inspiring as you can get. Stephanie, over to you.
Well, thank you very much. So the news covers resources, events, and then the news itself. So because nonviolence is about getting involved as much as it is about figuring out where our passion and our energy can meet the needs of the world and besides what's happening too. So a little bit more onto what Stephen Zunas said, there is a resource if people want to know more about the situation in Western Sahara. You can check out Western Sahara, War, Nationalism, and Conflict E-Resolution, authored by this week's Nonviolence Radio guest, Stephen Zunas.
And for our first resource, I'd like to say that Indivisible has local offices, and there is one in Sebastopol. It's indivisibleseb.org and Santa Rosa and Healdsburg. But the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict, to mention them again, has entered into a partnership with Rutgers University International Institute for Peace, and that jointly they will host a free, moderated online course called People Power, the Study of Strategic Nonviolent Resistance. And it's starting soon, September 27th to November 10th. Successful course participants become eligible for the ICNC grant opportunities and a certificate of completion. So I would comment this is another example of university movement collaboration, which is a wonderful development. If it had started 20 years earlier, I still might still be at Berkeley.
Mm-hmm. Would you call that a form of constructive program, Michael?
Definitely a form of constructive program. Yes. Thank you, Stephanie. It definitely is.
Okay. So is white supremacy only a problem of the American South? The answer, of course, is no. Sarah Van Gelder of Yes Magazine points out that there are many ways to uproot white supremacy within one's own community. She lists about 13, but surely there are more. And she says that rooting out white supremacy is not a task that belongs only to those communities with Confederate monuments. Every region of our country has its history of racial exclusion and white supremacy enforced to this day by domestic terrorism, laws, regulations, and police discrimination. Every region has seen people of color, especially African Americans, forced off land that they farmed, out of businesses, schools, voting booths, and often into poverty through menial underpaid work, overpriced slums, and police practices that disproportionately target people of color. And so she emphasizes really powerful, constructive ways of lifting up the voices for justice in all of our communities. So don't miss her article on Yes Magazine.
One last resource, then. Truth Out has an apparent, from myself, Truth Out has an apparently moving and very heartbreaking film, though I haven't seen all of it yet, called The Last Guardians. It's about the indigenous struggles against that powerful, diabolical combination of oil companies and governments, the governments of those very indigenous people. And this is the same the whole world over, and of course, against this powerful combination is the power of nonviolence. So you can watch the trailer and read the article through Truth Out. And yes, this is an example of constructive program.
Awesome. So are you, let's see, there's a movie out that seems like a good one for people to see. It's called Dolores. And Dolores Huerta is among the most important yet least known activists in American history. She's an equal partner in co-founding the first farm workers union with Cesar Chavez. And her enormous contribution have largely gone unrecognized. Dolores tirelessly led the fight for racial and labor justice alongside Chavez, becoming one of the most defiant feminists of the 20th century, and she continues to fight to this day at 87. With intimate and unprecedented access to this intensely private mother to 11, the film reveals the raw personal stakes involved in committing one's life to social change. It's directed by Peter Bratt. The film opened in U.S. theaters September 1st, and you can find that at local theaters or potentially online pretty soon. Also, Truth Out Interviews for Resistance is a nice new resource out there if you go to Truth Out. And it says that since election night 2016, the streets of the U.S. have rung with resistance. People all over the country have woken up with the conviction that they must do something to fight inequality in all its forms. But many are wondering what it is they can do. And it's an ongoing series called Interviews for Resistance, where experienced organizers, troublemakers, and thinkers share their insights on what works, what doesn't, and what hasn't changed, and what has changed. And what is still the same. And finally, we have another resource, and this is going to lead into some of the nonviolence news because of the hurricanes, Harvey and Irma. There's an sf72.org is an emergency preparedness site that's refreshingly calming and really well put together. And it can help people prepare for disaster. And what I really like about this resource is that it promotes connection and community. And so it suggests to people when you're preparing for your emergency kit that you bring your board games along and you're thinking about how to connect with your neighbors, how are you going to get in contact with your team of people, your family, and so forth. But there's another element to disaster response as well, and that's our inner preparation. The Meta Center has a resource on our website called The Inner Dimension of Emergency Preparedness. So we have to work to prepare ourselves ahead for tough situations so we can be at our best. And this means, you know, finding a mindfulness practice or something that we can do in order to calm ourselves at times of emergency. And all of this can relate to nonviolence as well, because Gandhi's idea of the Shanti Sena was not just about interrupting conflict as it's happening, but it's also about Shanti Sena volunteers, Peace Army volunteers going into communities and helping in disasters or helping when people get harmed by natural issues or even just helping to clean up communities. So you can do your nonviolence by preparing inwardly for emergencies and also getting out there and getting involved, which is all part of constructive program and person power. Michael.
Since we've mentioned several good films on the nonviolence side here, Stephanie, I'd like to point out on a more somber note that a recent survey was done and found that no less than 1,100 TV shows had received Pentagon backing, 900 of them since 2005. And the report says, the U.S. government and Hollywood have always been close, but we can now show that the relationship between U.S. national security, I'm putting security in quotes, and Hollywood is much deeper and more political than anyone has ever acknowledged. And I think it would be hard to overemphasize the importance of this direct propaganda pipeline in shaping people's consciousness toward militarism in this case.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And now into some more news. French artist J.R. created a giant image of a toddler that peers over the U.S.-Mexico border wall. According to Al Jazeera, the cutout of the boy stands nearly 20 meters tall and is meant to prompt discussion about immigration. It stands at the Tecate border crossing about 64 kilometers southeast of San Diego.
I want to bring up something that might seem controversial and that does come from the New York Times. It was an article called A Frightening Myth About Sex Offenders by David Feige. So it turns out that sex offenders have been labeled as having a frightening and high rate of recidivism, meaning returning to a life of crime after being released from prison. And investigators found that this frightening and high rate is based on one popular article that was quoted out of context. The myth is that 80% of sex offenders reoffend. That's a little bit higher than the national average of about 70 to 72%. But in reality, get this, the rate of reoffending is closer to 3%. So I was speculating about that this fact, and mind you, sex offense is a terrible thing and shouldn't happen, but this appalling fact fits perfectly into a pattern of scapegoat logic. In other words, a society that is suffering from tension looks around for people to scapegoat, and they need some people who are basically not people. They're dehumanized. And the term we often hear about sex offenders is that they are monsters. Therefore, the only thing you can do is to punish them and drive them out of society, Oedipus being the classic example. But it's amazing how fast and how completely this knee-jerk mythological horror has been inscribed in our legal system. If this was complete news to me. I believed everything they were saying until I saw this particular documentary and read this article by David Feige.
So ham radio, in other news, ham radio is a known hobby to many people, and it's a hobby that's meant to serve the community in times of crisis in particular. And in Houston, post-Hurricane Irma, ham radio operators came to the rescue of the community when all other technology failed them. And one ham radio operator, Luke Caliano, tuned into Texas from Lancaster, New York, and he sends radiograms to areas across the country in order to help support those who are facing disaster, and in particular in this case in Houston. And Caliano said, it feels really good because I'm giving back to the community, and this is what our hobby's all about. So way to go, ham radio operators.
We have a good system of ham radio set up at our ashram in LA, all ready to go. Well, we've been mentioning from time to time the campaign that's put on by Campaign Nonviolence, a project of Pache Bene, which attempts to have a week of actions in September 16th. And this one starts tomorrow, if you're listening live, on September 16th. It is the fourth Campaign Nonviolence Week of Actions. And I'm happy to report that they have been aiming for 1,000 events to be registered with them all around the country. And guess what? As of yesterday, they have 1,225 actions. These are actions for peace and nonviolence to end war, poverty, racism, and environmental destruction. Congratulations, CNV.
Mm-hmm. Turning now to more nonviolence post-Hurricanes Irma and Harvey, Abir and Nora al-Sheikh Bakri are sisters from Douma, Syria. This is an article from the Huffington Post. So basically what they did is when they heard And when they saw what was happening, they decided to try to help feed people in the situation. So they fled their homeland in 2012 after their country's civil war engulfed the city, and spent 4 years in Egypt before being resettled in Clarkson, Georgia in 2016 with other members of their family. And they said, suffice to say that they know what it's like to watch homes crumble before their eyes. So when Hurricane Irma bore its weight down on the southeastern U.S., displacing more than 500,000 people by Sunday, they sprung into action. And this is a quote, "I called my sister Noura and we got cooking," Abir, 28, told the Huffington Post. They drove about an hour to the Hamza Islamic Center in Alpharetta, Georgia, on Sunday evening, where they said about 39 evacuees were riding out the storm. And so they served them Middle Eastern dishes like tabbouleh and kebab. And Abir says, "We were uprooted from war, so we know the feeling of leaving everything behind." And Noura, 30, said, "I was so afraid when we heard about the hurricane, especially as Syrians were already traumatized."
Isn't that a beautiful thing, way to turn the negative into the positive?
And to connect that feeling of what it's like to lose one's home into the bigger issue about immigration and refugee status.
That's so correct. Just as many of the people who are fighting for gun control are people who have suffered from gun violence in their life. That's the way to use it. I wanted to mention that Representative Tulsi Gabbard from Hawaii, Democratic representative, has just introduced the Off Fossil Fuels for a Better Future Act, called the Off Act. It was introduced last week. We presently have a moratorium on new fossil fuel projects, but this would move the country to 100% renewable energy by 2035, with, and this is important, with a focus on a rapid transition in the next 10 years. And the bill has been co-sponsored by a lot of representatives, and interesting and more encouraging than even than that, as of yesterday, more than 300 groups have signed in support, including the Meta Center for Nonviolence. And we will, in the print version of this news, we will have a link where you can sign up your organization.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Michael. In other news, The Nation released a statement of solidarity with Michael Bennett, that was an American football player, that was released and signed by people like Angela Davis and Arundhati Roy and Naomi Klein and the editors at The Nation, and among others. And they say, "We, the undersigned, stand with Michael Bennett, a professional football player with the Seattle Seahawks, philanthropist and activist following an incident of police brutality in Las Vegas. On the morning of August 27th, the reported shooting on the Vegas Strip led to chaos. Michael Bennett ran for cover, as did hundreds of others. Instead of being assisted, video and photographic evidence shows that Las Vegas police targeted Bennett, put him on the ground in handcuffs while the primary officer took out a weapon, placed it near the back of his head. According to Bennett, the officer said that if he moved, he would be shot. And Bennett was then put in a police car and, after a period of time, let go without charges. And they said, "We condemn this act of racial profiling and excessive force perpetrated by the Vegas police against Mr. Bennett." So these kinds of statements help to show that there is solidarity and support for when injustice takes place, and that can be an important tool in our nonviolence toolbox.
A very uplifting note. I know that many of us have been concerned about the black-footed ferret, right? We've been worried about these creatures.
Because we thought they were extinct.
We have thought that they were extinct since 1979, and that's really a shame, because these are like the cutest rodents you ever saw in your life, with little black noses and little black feet. They're so sweet. And in 1979, we had some in captivity, and the last one died. The species was declared extinct, and that was, again, a pity, because it was the only ferret native to North America.
Wow.
And there are several things that wipe them out. But guess what? They're back. They've been discovered in Wisconsin, and there's something like 500 of them ferreting around out there, and they're impossibly cute. It's delightful. It's delightful to know that nature is resilient.
Nonviolence in the news is delightful, to go from from one situation to another, because nonviolence encompasses all aspects of our environment and life and people. So this is really good news. Thank you, Michael. Yeah.
I hadn't drawn that conclusion, Stephanie, but it's very, very sound. I want to move on to some events. The Mill Valley Seniors for Peace is sponsoring a talk by myself called Nonviolence Now, what's going well, and how can we help. That'll be Monday, September 25th, 3 to 4:30 p.m. at the Redwoods in Mill Valley. If you want to know more or RSVP, write to Angela Dawn Parker, written as one word, angeladawnparker@gmail.com. You had some more news, I think, Stephanie.
Well, since we've moved on to events, I do want to say that if anybody's looking for more nonviolence news and community, they can join the Meta Center for Nonviolence every Wednesday morning, pretty early, 8:15 to 9:15 a.m. Pacific time, for an in-depth online discussion about nonviolence in the news and looking at various sources, including Waging Nonviolence, which I do have one item from Waging Nonviolence I'd like to share. You can contact the Meta Center for Nonviolence to get involved in that. And then on Monday, September 18th, this is the week of the International Day of Peace next week, on Monday at Aquas Cafe at 6:30 p.m., which is in Petaluma, the Meta Center will be hosting Restorative Resources, an organization from Santa Rosa, and some students to have a community conversation with the Petaluma community about restorative justice in our schools. And we hope that you can join us there. And this is sort of a resource, because Waging Nonviolence is a great resource. And an event happened, actually. So it's event, resource, and news all together. And there was resistance of a violent arms fair, and it's been resisted very, very creatively. There's an article on Waging Nonviolence by Andrew Mitta, even. And this is what he says. In London, thousands of protesters have been taking direct action to shut down one of the world's biggest arms fairs, the Defense and Security Equipment International. And it opened on September 12th, but the exhibition center where it was held was repeatedly blockaded during the week before it began as activists were preparing to disrupt it. It appears that, he says, on the sheer scale of resistance over the last week overwhelmed the police and organizers of the event, as did the creativity and determination of many groups who were involved. Each day was organized by different groups that made up the Stop the Arms Fair Coalition, and to allow them to plan their own actions alongside like-minded people with similar concerns. And this approach allowed groups and campaigns that have not typically worked together to find common cause in resisting the fair. So this is what we've also been talking about in the idea of the roadmap strategy of let's bring various people, various organizations, various interests together to resist one item at a time, and it can strengthen all of our movements.
And that's an increasing trend. Well, I can't match your triple whammy of events, resource, and news, but I wanted to mention two events very quickly. It's, again, local and timely, on September 21st and 22nd in Sacramento, an event called California 2020 is being put on by the Shift Network. And I think that they have some wonderful speakers, and they will be talking about successful long-term strategies, which is the subject of the forthcoming issue of our nonviolence magazine. And these strategies always build up from the small to the large, and that is what they're planning to do. Then on Wednesday in New York, this is from Maria Stefan of the United States Institute of Peace, there'll be a forum on how nonviolent grassroots movements can advance more just, peaceful, and inclusive societies. This is building up from a couple of General Assembly and Security Council resolutions. And again, I think there'll be some very brilliant and creative people there if you're in the New York area.
Great. Thank you so much, Michael Nagler. This is Nonviolence Radio. This has been your Nonviolence in the News. We hope you come back in 2 weeks. And until the next time, everybody, take care of one another. Ciao.